Here we go, 8 o'clock. So the title of, I'm going to give the today's talk a title. It kind of fits in, and also I promised to talk about this earlier on in the retreat, and that was the nature of the will. So this is more like the insight, but it's also, it does affect the way that people meditate. And it answers some of those questions which people always ask me about that way of meditating where you just let things be, you let go, you don't do anything, you're still, you don't strive, but you just were very careful not to strive, that you are the dog in the cockpit who bites the pilot every time the pilot tries to do something, and that story. You are the person who is sitting perfectly still under the mango tree and just hold out your hand and then these amazing things fall right into your hand. All of those similes I've given so far, you can notice in each one of those, what about this thing we call will? Aren't you supposed to develop right effort? Ajahn Brahm, you are distorting the Eightfold Path. What's wrong with you? And I will tell you that I've got no choice. I have to teach like this. It's not my choice. What is the will? And this is where we're going to talk about the nature of the will. I just got a couple of notes down here because sometimes I forget the right quotes. So I just got some just on a piece of paper here. But anyway, the nature of the will. What actually is it? I'm going to start off with the science. And if you haven't heard this yet, when you get back, not to your room, because you're not supposed to use the computers in your room, or your handphones or whatever, and you can't get a good signal anyway. But when you go back home, you can check this out on the internet. There was this professor called Professor John Libet, L-I-B-E-T. What university was he at? Do you remember? I don't know, anyway. There's only one of them, L-I-B-E-T. And because he was at university, and you know, he did some research on the nature of this thing we call will. Have you ever really noticed your will? And be mindful of when you're meditating and see this desire, or this will, this want come up, this aspiration. And please be careful of the different words for the will, because sometimes, I think I mentioned already, in the course's form of it, we say it's craving. And that's been associated with the second noble truth, and that's bad. But then again, we have this word called aspiration. And we think that's always associated with aspiring for good things in life. So that's good. But those two things mean exactly the same. Aspiration and will. Aspiration is one of the types of will. And look at how life actually works. I never ask for any water, but some comes. There's no will involved. I'd even aspire for it. But nevertheless, here it comes. Have you ever noticed that life is like that? Some of the best things in life come, and you never strive for it, never wanted it, but it's very nice. Thank you. It's warm as well. Warm water. Is it fresh? Did it come straight from the sky this morning? It is sometime. Anyhow, so Professor Libet, he did these experiments, and they were extremely simple experiments, but very convincing. Many, many students at his university, and all they had was on their left hand a little button they could press, and their right hand, they would decide, when they decided to flex their fists, now to close them, to open them, and when they were aware of the will, when they chose, and they were aware of that choice to close their fist, they would press the button. When they decided to open it, they would press the button. As best as they can, no being, silence, no disturbance on them. They could choose when they open their fist, when they close their fist. And at the same time that there was these ECGs, or EEGs rather, on their brain to see what their brain was up to, you know, when they was doing this experiment. And what they found was before, you know, it was a really good experiment. They took into account, you know, the reaction times, you know, when they decided to press the button and when they decided, you know, that actually the choice was, they were aware of the choice. And they found that the actual experience of will on someone who's even like a meditator, when you experience the decision, yes, I'm going to move, that happens after this thing which he could see in the computer screens called, he called it the readiness potential. The sequence of events were the brain lights up somewhere, and then, I think it's about 0.4 of a second or 0.6 of a second, something like that, 0.6 of a second after the brain turns on and decides to do it, then you are aware of the will. And then about a little, another sort of 0.4 of a second, then, or, yeah, no, 0.4 of a second, then you actually act. The sequence, there's a readiness potential in the brain. About half a second later, you're aware of will, and then another half a second, you perform the act. And that was sort of consistent. It's such a simple experiment. He could do that thousands of times. And what it was proving is when you are aware of this thing which you call will, it's already happening. The thing which you can be aware of as will is not what initiates the action. That action is already initiated, and you are unconscious of that initiation of this act in your brain. The brain decides first, then a little bit later you're aware of the will, and then a little bit later you act. And the point is, because you're not aware of the brain starting this process, you always assume that the will, this thing which you can be aware of, is what initiates the process. But it doesn't. By the time you're aware of this decision, it's already happening. And so this thing we call will is not what decides what to do. Decisions are made unconsciously beforehand. Only half a second. But he said the one thing you can do is you can decide not to follow through. You can interrupt the process. So he said in a very beautiful way, there's no such thing as free will. What there is free won't. You can restrain, you can let go, you can say no. Now that was what science was saying. And of course, that fits in with just ordinary experience of life. Why are you wearing the clothes you're wearing now? Okay, monks and nuns, we've got no choice, we have to wear these things. But you, why? Why do you have your hair in the way you do? It's kind of fashion, isn't it? Other people do that, and you do that as well. I remember so many times. I remember being young, being a little bit of a rebel, trying to be an individual young man, and I went to one of these Isle of Wight festivals. And when I went down there, it was just a bunch of hippies, basically. I never took drugs myself, but I looked like one, a hippie. And I already mentioned, I had much more hair than I have now. Really bushy hair like Jimi Hendrix, he was my idol. And when my hair finished, that's when my beard began. It was very good in cold weather. I didn't need to wear hats. You had the sort of insulation all around. And I remember for years and years, my mother kept on telling me, get your hair cut. You know, don't have so much hair. And then when I finally did, she said, "That's not what I meant." So anyway. But then when I went to this Isle of Wight festival, and then, you know what I bought to go down there, what I thought was really cool, was green velvet trousers. So I had my pair of green velvet trousers, believe it or not, and I went down to the Isle of Wight festival, and then I thought I was being original, being unique, but I saw so many hundreds of other young men wearing green velvet trousers. It wasn't original at all, it was part of another uniform. And because of that, I started doubting this idea of choice. And even worse than that, many of you know this story, it's true, that I went to Cambridge, a really good university. And so when I was not just studying, looking for girlfriends and stuff, and so I saw on the TV the advertisement for St. Bruno tobacco. Now, we didn't know that smoking was bad for your health. I never smoked cigarettes, but like a pipe. Albert Einstein was always photographed smoking this pipe. And all these other famous scientists always had a pipe, especially physicists. It's almost like part of your uniform, have a pipe and be smoking something while you're breaking through the unified field theory or something. Somehow or other, that was part of your uniform again. But this advertisement, I saw this advertisement, a young man, about my age at the time, it was on the advert, walking down the streets of some town in UK somewhere. And people were ignoring him, but then he got out his pipe and put some Bruno tobacco in that pipe, lit it. And as soon as he started smoking it, just in one of the shops, there was this absolutely gorgeous young blonde woman. It's on the advert. She jumped over the counter when she smelt the fragrance of some Bruno tobacco and started following him, just waiting for his first command. And then... Okay, it's male fantasies, okay. And then he went down a little bit further down the street. There's a greengrocer and the lady, a beautiful brunette. She too smelt the aroma of some Bruno tobacco. And she left her post and went following him as well. And then a beautiful redhead. And all the most incredibly beautiful women were following this ordinary looking guy. And then they had the motto, the slogan of the advert, that some Bruno tobacco, irresistible to women. That's crazy, isn't it? Any intelligent person wouldn't get sucked into that. I did. I brought some. Put it in a pipe, started smoking it down one of the streets of Cambridge. The only female following me, I don't know if it really was a female, was a dog. Everybody else left me alone. But I'm glad I did that, because it's simple just how these advertisements suck you in, how they bend your will. I was intelligent. I was doing theoretical physics at Cambridge. I think that qualifies as being intelligent. But how did I get sucked in? This is the psychology of advertising. This is why people in business always say that $1 spent in advertising usually makes you $3. This is on average, $3 return. It's incredibly profitable. But why? Surely you're intelligent enough to know that this can't occur, but somehow or other your brain gets brainwashed, gets hypnotized with what you want and a means to get it which really don't fit, but you trust it anyway. And that's also, you know, with politics as well. Why political parties spend a lot of money on advertising. Can't you make up your own mind? And the answer is no. And on top of that, we had these, part of what I followed at Cambridge was psychic research. Now I'd tell jokes about ghosts, and one of the reasons is, you know, that you know what they are. They're not fearful at all. And also, I let you into another secret. You know why ghosts and spirits can't come into Jhana Grove? Have you heard the quality of our chanting, especially in the morning? Out of key, just sometimes really out of key. No self-respecting ghost can stand that type of chanting. Ah! And they all run away. Beautiful chanting, you know, attracts heavenly beings. But the sort of chanting which we do or I do, it scares everybody away. But no, because we used to go and investigate, find out what's going on and what's actually happening. And so many of these phenomena that it's not whether they exist or not is the interesting thing, but why some people just can't see it. Because they just deny it. And one of my friends, he came to one of our conferences here in Perth, because he was a mate in Cambridge. And I never knew for years just what he was up to. I knew he stayed in theoretical physics and was working on one of his things he worked on was on white holes. Like black holes, they can decay because of Hawking radiation. But I never realized how close he was to Stephen Hawking, you know, the famous scientist. And he was actually one of the inner circle. And so when there was a movie about the life of Stephen Hawking, this, my friend Bernard, he was featured in the film. It was an actor played his part. And that because of that, that Bernard and his wife, Stephen Hawking went to their wedding, and Bernard and his wife were invited to the premiere. The only time in his life he's walked down the red carpet, you know, on a premiere in Leicester Square. He said, it's really cool, because as a physicist, you never expected to be a movie star. He wasn't really acting in the film, but somebody represented him, so he got a gig walking on the red carpet. But anyway, as well as being sort of a top scientist, he's currently Emeritus Professor of Theoretical Physics at, I think, Queen Mary College in London University. But he was also the president of the London Society of Psychic Research. Ghost hunting. Not just, you know, for sensationalism, but actually with all the equipment you can possibly borrow from your university to find out what's actually there. But it's not just ghost hunting. Had all these other things him and his friends got up to as well. And one of those was the proof of levitation. Levitation is a psychic phenomena. Does it exist? Have you ever seen it? Has it ever been verified in a laboratory, in a university? So that one of his friends said he could do this. So they did this experiment in Imperial College in London. Imperial College is one of the great technological universities in London. And they have many great discoveries there. And so this physicist, one of Bernard's friends, said he discovered, you know, levitation, and he wanted to demonstrate it to his peers. Not just to the media, only to people who were experimental physicists, theoretical physicists, lecturers, professors, to his colleagues. And so because of that, there was no students or no press involved. they all came. And remember those old laboratories? You know, you used to have this big laboratory bench in the front, a blackboard in the back, and the seats going up in the, I think they're called bleachers. And so this was not filled by students, this day. It was filled by other professors and lecturers and well-known physicists. And he came in to the lecture theatre carrying a flower pot. He was carrying it. No strings. He put it on the bench. And he said, "I'm now going to levitate this flower pot." And of course, you know, people thought it was... They didn't actually think it was a joke, because this was a serious physicist. And then he asked them, "I need your help to be able to do this. And the help is, I want you to chant a mantra." And the mantra was just that single word, Om. And, you know, I know these professors. They're just so conservative. And the fact that all these professors were compliant and they all started chanting Om, Om, Om. And they started the cameras, because if it worked, they wanted it to be recorded for posterity. And when they were chanting Om, 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 the flower pot lifted up above the table. It levitated. And then it went down again. And they stopped chanting. It was photographed, videoed in UV cameras, infrared cameras, because these universities got all the most wonderful, expensive gear. And then people were stunned. And then he asked a couple of the physicists there, "These are ones who do experiments, who record the data fairly, objectively, so they say, and ask them all, what happened?" And these two observers, they said that flower pot never moved at all. It was on the table all the time. They were there, they were watching, they saw it, it didn't move at all. It was on the table. And then he showed them the videos. That's all fake videos. We were here, we saw it, never moved. And that was the whole purpose of the experiment. The point was, the truth was, that flower pot did lift above the table. But that was such an impossible thing to happen for someone who's been trained in science to say, that can't happen. And they didn't even see it. They weren't conscious of it. It never registered in their brain. All the time, all they saw was that flower pot on the table, continuously. It did rise above the table. But it wasn't anything supernatural. Underneath that table, at great effort and great expense, they had installed this huge electromagnet. And the only reason why they had to ask everybody to start chanting Om, 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 because when you turn on the electricity for such a power-hungry magnet, you can hear the electricity flowing through it. There was a hum when you turn on a very strong current, and they had to do the Om to hide the turning on of the electricity, that's all. The Om was just a mask, so the professors there wouldn't see what was really going on. But the point was, there's a couple of those professors didn't even see it rise. And it did rise. But they blocked it out of their perception. And that's one of the amazing things about our brain. We think whatever we see, whatever we hear, even whatever we know, we can rely on. And it's scary when you know you can't. Some things happen, and they're just so much what you don't want to see. You're blind to it. So they did some amazing experiments like that, and that of just how our wants, our desires, our safety zone, prevents us seeing the whole truth. We only see part of it. That is why sometimes something like will, we don't fully understand what's going on. It's very challenging to doubt that your will is what you're in charge of and what decides where you go and what you do. Even, I know there's a few people from US here, they always keep chanting, the land of the free. Ha ha ha. Are you really free in the US? Or are you heavily brainwashed? Are you able to know the difference? That's when it gets scary. So in another of these experiments, which we did in a university in Cambridge, a hypnotist, I already mentioned the power of hypnotism, it can access your mind straight away. And this hypnotist came in and just asked for any volunteers. I volunteered, so I was not a good hypnotic subject. But there's always one or two students were good hypnotic subjects. And this one young man, just an ordinary young man, not crazy, just quite intelligent, but able to be hypnotized. They got him in this trance and they made him do all sorts of silly things. It was all good entertainment, a bit of fun and games for the observers like me. But then one of the things they asked this student to do, the hypnotist said, when I touch my right earlobe, doesn't matter what time or what you're doing, you will stand up, no matter what anything else is happening, stand up and sing in a loud voice the British national anthem from beginning to end. Now, when I take you out of hypnosis, you won't remember that, but when I touch my right earlobe, this is what you'll do. You'll stand up and sing God Save the Queen. And of course, his friends, we never told him what was going to happen. We didn't want to spoil the fun. We almost might say quite sadistic, but I'm glad we never did anything because it taught me so much what actually happened next. We were all waiting for him to touch his right earlobe. And he was a good entertainer, the hypnotist. He would go close and then scratch his cheek or something. But then eventually, they took him out of hypnosis. The young man sat down in the audience and then he touched his right earlobe. Imagine I hypnotized one of you during the interviews. And I said, when I scratch my nose, you will stand up and sing the Australian national anthem. And imagine I did that. And then one of you just stood up and started singing, Australians, or let us rejoice. I think that's how it starts, isn't it? Yeah, I think so. But anyway, imagine you did that and you stood up in the middle of my talk and you weren't even Australian, you were from Hong Kong or somewhere. You stood up and sang that in a loud voice and you wouldn't stop. How would you react? You would probably do what I did. I laughed my head off when this young English boy started singing God Save the Queen. Not just me laughing, everybody in the room were just howling with laughter. It's one of the funniest things we saw. And that never stopped this guy. He kept on singing the British national anthem in a loud voice. He wouldn't stop until he was finished. And then we could sit down and just sort of recover from all that really extreme laughter. And even though everybody else in the room was laughing, it didn't affect him at all. He sang the whole lot of the British national anthem. And then the lecturer, the hypnotist, asked everyone to sit quiet down a moment. And then he asked the boy, why did you do that? And that was when it got really scary. This man, young student, gave a logical reason. I can't remember what the reason was, but a sensible reason why he decided to sing the British national anthem. What he said convinced me, and just shivers down my back, convinced me that he was of the clear opinion that he decided out of his own free will to sing the British national anthem. It was a totally irrational, illogical, stupid thing to do. And even though everyone was laughing at him, he would not stop. And he had a reason for that. And that reason convinced him, or rather the fact that he believed in free will, convinced him that was a totally free choice to do something stupid. And that started me thinking, all those other things I believe is my will. My will to meditate, my will to give a talk, your will to go here, to go there. Is that really your own free will? Or have you been, let's not call it hypnotized, conditioned, influenced, brainwashed, whatever you wish to call it, to do this and not do that? When you meditate, why do you watch your breath? Did your mum and dad teach you how to watch your breath? When you went to school, is that what they said? Where do you get that idea from? It is brainwashing. I know that. And I'm very happy to brainwash you in noble, good ways, which will lead to a lot of health, peace, and wisdom. But that's what this will really is. And that actually can change your meditation. First of all, when you know that your meditation, you didn't decide to do it. It appears that way. Acknowledge that. You decide. That's the appearance, but it's already been the readiness potential comes before you, aware of any will. So what that means, number one, all the mistakes of your life, all the errors which sometimes you feel ashamed of, did you really do those? Or was it just this cause and effect process, which like being caught in a stream when the river is flooded and it washes you here, washes you there, and you can't resist it? You're not strong enough to resist it. You didn't decide to flow downstream, it's just the current pushed you downstream. Is it your fault? And after a while you realize that all the stuff which you did in the past, which you sometimes feel ashamed of, you think, I wish I hadn't have done that. Sometimes you can't really fully blame yourself. And you realize you can't really blame others. The only thing to ever do is to forgive. And make sure you don't get in those situations again where you do similar acts which are hurtful and cause problems for you as well. But the idea of blame and scolding start to disappear. That's one of the reasons why when a person does understand fully the fact that your will is not a self, doesn't come from you. That's one of the reasons why that degree of understanding of non-self means that never again will you get reborn in one of the lower realms. Even though you do deserve, I don't like the word anyway, punishment, you think you deserve to be punished, you just can't do it anymore. There's no real reason to punish. It's just pointless. It wasn't really your fault. And also, it's not, you don't feel proud of any attainments. So you don't go boasting, I'm a stream winner. Stream winner, after all the years you've been a monk, oh come on, Ajahn Brahm. And him over there is a once returner. Are you really a once returner? You know, somebody asked me this question online. They said there was this fellow Sarakhani, sometimes called Saranani, it's two suttas, but obviously the same person. And he was an alcoholic. He'd get drunk, he'd take alcohol. And the end of his life, the Buddha declared him, oh yeah, he was a stream winner. Does that mean you don't have to keep that fifth precept? You can still be a stream winner? And that gives many people in Australia hope. No, it doesn't mean that at all. Because sometimes, you know, there's only one person like that. Don't think that that's the standard. that sometimes that was the guy had just so much faith and confidence in every other which way he was excellent. It just, he had that one stupid attachment. But anyway, all of these things we think, now what should we do, what should we shouldn't do? Instead of our decisions, you find we are inspired, is a wonderful word. The inspired means you're conditioned by the power of, you see something really good and noble and wonderful, and you, it's so delightful, you want more of that. That inspires you to practice deeper. Even the little things which I say that, yes, you can get jhanas on this retreat. I said, but I've been just doing nothing all the time. I've just been sleeping. I've just been going into my room looking at the internet. And I've been doing much at all, much meditation. Yeah, I tell other people I'm just meditating in my room, but I'm not really meditating in my room. I'm sleeping or messing around. And then I say, you can still get jhanas on this retreat. And they say, Ajahn Brahm, you're crazy. But you can. It's much harder, much more difficult, but it's possible. When I say that, because you have trust in me, I hope, it becomes possible for you. You know, when you're talking about the jhanas, for years, you know, we're not really supposed to talk about jhanas as monks, believe it or not. And in Vietnam especially, the United Buddhist Sangha, this is a group of Mahayanas and Theravadins. Theravadins are in the south, mostly. Vajrayanas in the north. The Mahayanas in the north. It was wonderful the way they would always work together. They would have meetings and discuss stuff. And one of the things they discussed was, you know, should monks teach jhanas to lay people? And they said no. There's too much trouble. And that kind of shocked me. They've changed the decision these days. So you were a layperson in Vietnam, and if someone did teach you jhanas, it was just kind of illegal. They get into trouble for that. And even in Thailand, you know, when I started teaching jhanas to lay people, I got criticism as well. I remember just going to one monastery in the UK, and I was about to go into the main reception area, and then another monk was coming out, and he looked around, he grabbed me by the shoulder, looked around. You know, what are you doing this for? I thought he was going to give me something sort of illegal or something, like a Playboy magazine or something. And he didn't want to get caught. And he just saw that no one was listening to him, and he said, Ajahn Brahm, thank you for teaching jhanas. And that kind of shocked me. He said, thank you for teaching jhanas. He didn't want anyone else to hear that. It was like I was doing something subversive. We're teaching the Eightfold Path. Honestly, that's what it felt like. Of course, most of the monks have come around now and they just teach these jhanas to themselves, to the nuns, and to you. Why not? I can't really understand that. But anyway, that was just the conditioning which they had. Anyway, so also that many of you think that, you know, I should focus more on right effort. But there is a couple of beautiful suttas, and I just remember them so I don't mess around with them. This is in the Anguttara 10, sutta number 2. You can check it out, Anguttara 10, sutta number 2. And I know Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, first of all, alerted me to that, and he wrote a little booklet about it. Enlightenment is a natural process. Enlightenment is a natural process. And it has this conditional sequence. For one who is virtuous, they do not need to will. Let me be free from remorse and regret. Freedom from remorse and regret will happen naturally. of the Pali word tamata. In Pali, I knew that word because they used to call it tamada, ordinary, natural. For one who is virtuous, you have freedom from regret. That's pretty obvious, isn't it? You don't have to say, oh man, I'll be free of all regret when you're virtuous. For one who has freedom from regret, they do not need to will, oh, let me be happy. This is a certain type of happiness, pamoja, because it's natural that one who is free from regret has a certain type of happiness. And even from this, I just recall that, you know, why do you keep 5 precepts, 8 precepts, 311 precepts? Why do you do that? It's because it's a cause of happiness. You have a much happier lifestyle when you keep precepts, when you're virtuous. It's like just, you know, the simile of the water level in the sea. You know, from keeping virtue, the whole level of the water goes up. So you still have bad days and good days, but the average days are much more happy than they were before. You don't have to will, oh, let me be happier. It occurs naturally. When you're good, you experience good times. And then for one who's happy, this pamuja, they don't need to will, oh, may I experience this pity, this joy. It is natural that one who has this pamuja, this general happiness, will experience more pity, more joy. The more virtuous you are, the average level of happiness comes up, and sometimes you reach these peaks of happiness, the great pity. It's natural, of course it will happen. You don't need to do it. And I mean, how many of you, during interviews and during the question time, say you're getting peaceful, but you haven't got enough joy yet in the meditation? You can watch the breath, it's peaceful, but it's not just gorgeous. Why? One of the things I didn't tell you, check your virtue. And virtue is just not being like a goody-goody, keeping the precepts, that everybody else how well you see that, how well you keep those precepts. I often say that, I usually have to do this to be fair to both our main support bases. When you went into a Sri Lanka temple in Melbourne, I saw some people, it was on a Waisak day, they were keeping not 5 precepts or 8 precepts, they were keeping 13 precepts. And I never heard that before. I said, what are the 13 precepts? Oh, we keep 8 precepts in the morning and at lunch we switch to 5 precepts. It's crazy. The main difference between 8 precepts and 5 precepts, and 8 precepts, you decide not to eat in the afternoon and evening. So they only keep that in the morning. And the Thais, they're just as sneaky. For years and years and years, I was living in Thailand, practicing there, and I never saw this until years after I left. And I went back there, and I saw people, when they're giving the 5 precepts, they had one finger down. I thought, have you hurt your finger or something? They said, no, no, no. Because today I'm only keeping 4 precepts. And they still chanted all 5 because they didn't want to lose face. And of course, once I saw that and the fellow explained it to me honestly, I took a look around. Someone was only keeping 3 precepts that day. I haven't got my fingers, I don't know. How many fingers have I got here? And eventually you kept on looking and you saw one person. They still did Parnati Patavera Amani. They did a ceremony but had absolutely zero meaning. So, but when you are virtuous, I don't know why people want to break their virtue. It makes you generally happier. And not just generally happier, these things called pity arises much more easily. It's joy. And the next thing it says, I've got the wrong page. When you experience joy, you do not need to will, Oh, let me be tranquil. There's two types of tranquility, bodily tranquility and mental tranquility. Even your body becomes peaceful. That's what tranquility means, pasadi. Your body becomes much more healthy when you keep precepts. It's not because of heavenly reward, it's just nature. Feel good about yourself, you feel much more relaxed. You're not so afraid. And I still remember one example. This disciple died and he made me the executor of his will. He didn't have any close family here, he just used to come to our Buddhist society. He made me executor of the will. And so when he died, the police had to come and inform me. I was basically the next of kin, even though I was not related to him at all. And so when the police came, I just noticed a couple of visitors or anagarikas. And as soon as they saw a police car arrive, they went around the back of the kitchen building and hid. They were not so sure of what the police were coming for. Or who they were coming for. So there's always a bit of tension and tightness there. And I'm really amazed that, because I've just lived such a good life, if any police come, I can treat them, hi, how are you going? What can I do for you? You're not at all scared or afraid because I've done nothing, been a really good monk for so many years. So, and a lot of time, even when you go through the customs inspections at airports, that's always really good fun. Because sometimes, they ask me, said, what have you got in your bag, sir? Have you got any liquids or gels? You got any hair gel? One of them did that to me once, and I looked at him and said, excuse me. And I had a big smile on my face. He started laughing as well, I'll go through. It's great when you're honest. We have those relics, the Buddha relics we've got on our shrine over in Bodhinyana. They were given to me by this Burmese monk. They're legitimate, real relics. And so he said, you're doing a really good job, so I want to send some of these relics to Bodhinyana Monastery, for everybody to make it easier. So I took those relics, had to take them through customs in Perth. Those forms that you have, anything to declare. And I looked through the list there, and one of them, I said, got to declare them, I suppose. But, what do they classify as? And it was like human remains, or human parts, body parts. So I ticked that box. I wish that, apparently they do some TV recordings at Perth airports, so Australian airports. I wish I had a TV camera there. That would be a classic. So, have you got anything to declare? And they looked at bodily parts. What do you mean, body parts? And I took them out and I said, what are those? They said, they're bones, human bones. And the bones of the Buddha, 2,500 years old. And he looked at me, really? Yeah, he said, I've got to get the boss out. So they got the head of the customs. And the guy came out and he said, what's the problem? He said, this monk is importing bodily bones. He had a look at it. This is weird because they're all in these beautiful canisters or little stupas, like glass stupas. I said, what is this? He said, this is relics of the Buddha which were offered to me to take to our temple for worship. And he looked at me and he said, this is way too difficult for me. Get out of here. That's exactly what he said, just get out of here, because it was just too difficult. It wouldn't cause any problem. So that's one of the reasons. If you have your virtue, you don't need to feel fear at all. You get a lot of fun. And you got this bodily tranquility. It's easy to be at peace. It's easy to go to sleep at night. It's easy to sit here and just have no real problems in your body. And that leads to tranquility of the body, which leads to this type of happiness, a meditation happiness, sukha. It's like, you know, one step up from pity, more peaceful, more beautiful. And you don't have to think, oh, may I experience joy and happiness in meditation. I've been trying to emphasize this, that the joy, when you see the delightful, beautiful breath, it will come to you anyway. Sometimes you're surprised. It's there. Wow, I'm really enjoying this. I mean, really, big sukha, powerful sukha. And what was it that's... Yeah, it's amazing. And then from the sukha, the happiness, that is one of the main causes for jhanas. One of the things which the Buddha said, sukhino cittang samadhiyati, which translates as, from happiness, the mind becomes still, enters jhana. It never enters jhana through unhappiness, through stress, through force, through tension. All of that has to vanish. And then the doors of jhana open. And this is not what you do. It's just what happens. And that's a brilliant thing, that people, they do these meditations and they strive, they do stuff, and that's why it usually happens on the last day. So don't even try today. It's not the last day, it won't happen until Sunday. Just take a rest, take a sleep, mess around. I shouldn't say that, should I? From the last day it happens. It's amazing how many times the last day. That's why I think I should never do 9-day retreats, just do 1-day retreat. So every day is the last day. Watch out. But anyway, it's because they get out of the way and let it happen naturally. You're good people, you've done the best you possibly could, and virtuous. It's very hard to break precepts in this retreat. Yeah, you've got your own room, but there's always a neighbour there. So any funny business, they'll find out. There's plenty of nice food. You don't need to sneak into the kitchen in the evening and make yourself a meal. You don't need to... they do this, you know. I should have let you know. There's many shops, like in Byford, they can deliver pizza at 1 a.m. Cottage number 6, room number 2. Knocking on your door. You don't need to do that. They get the wrong address anyway. Once one of the monks, is a very, very, very good monk, that once he went into the office, there was a new monk as my attendant in the evening drinks, that's between 6 and 7. And so a new attendant, and so this monk, he went into the office, we have 2 phones down there, he used one phone to call the phone which the attendant was monitoring, in case, you know, any of you had a call to make in the evening. And so I was next to the attendant, and the attendant could receive this call. And they say, this is, I think, Domino's Pizza. We have a delivery for you of a pizza, but the gate is locked. What should we do? And the one making the call was the monk. He was just... putting a prank on this young monk, and I was next to him, and he soon figured out who it was, who laughed our heads off. So when you're good, you don't be afraid of anything and have little fun and games like that, because no one takes that seriously. And it's also, that means you very easily get into these jhanas. And another question that somebody will ask, I'm sure, yes, when you get into jhanas, when should you do insight meditation? Should you then switch to insight meditation? No. It happens naturally. For one who emerges from a jhana, you don't have to will or make the choice. Oh, may I see things as they truly are. It's natural. It's automatic. The one who exits from a jhana will see things as it truly is. You've got no choice. You become enlightened, whether you like it or not. Of course you like it. So wisdom comes naturally. Your mind is cleared. It's got no hindrances. And of course you see things as they truly are. Yata bhuta yana dasana. See things as they truly are. And when you see things as they truly are, do you need to will, oh, may I be enlightened? No, it happens naturally. With that wisdom, you know, you are enlightened. Just all those ideas of a self, that I'm the one who does this, fade away. And that's why these are powerful teachings. It's a natural process. The only thing the will does is actually what Professor Libet said, free won't. You can hinder the path, disturb the path, delay the path when you start to do things. Otherwise, just let go, disappear. And again, I did mention this earlier. It's just an interesting that many of you have been exposed to other religions. And I know there was some people who, from religions such as from later on Hinduism, not in the time of the Buddha, but and even in Christianity, where some of these people did seem to enter jhanas. How come? The reason was they could let go of their will. They would call it surrendering. Surrendering to a higher power. If they do that, when their will starts to vanish, of course, then these jhanas can happen. Trouble is that as soon as it happens, then they come out afterwards, they interpret it in their own ways of perception, and they don't actually see the total truth. Just like even scientists, they can't see the fact that that flower pot lifted up above the table, it gets blocked out. So anyhow, this is how the will, which we think is important, actually is the obstacle. Enemy number one. I say that carefully, not a joke. You know what they call the will in Pali? Sankara. I thought it was just the will is part of Sankara. But Ajahn Brahmani pointed out to me, and anyone who wants to look it up, I'll get the quote correct. Is Sanyutta Nikaya number 22. There's a 22nd Sanyutta Nikaya in Sutta 56 and 57. And the Buddha said, Sankara is the sixth Chetana. Chetana Kaya, he said. Kaya just means a group. The six forms of Chetana. The will associated with each of the six different senses. That's what Sankara is. So said the Buddha. Samyutta Nikaya 22, 56 and 57. Of course, it has offshoots. That's the core meaning of Sankara. And it sort of goes, obviously, where that's the active part of Sankara. It's what actually is created by that will. It also counts as Sankara, but the core part of it is will. That's why the Buddha also said, I'm just finishing off, there's very few people in this world will ever understand what he calls sabba sankhara samatha. The samatha, the stilling of all will. Some of you may have experienced that, getting deep into meditation. The world has got so still it vanishes. No will left. You wouldn't believe just how beautiful that is. Later on, if any of you manage to get into a second jhana, that is the bliss of second jhana. The fact that it's no will left. Perfectly still. Really perfectly still for hours. You think, isn't that boring? Then you feel stuck. Oh my goodness, please stick me here for longer. This is, and I often mention this, when that will disappears, then you have an idea what will is, or rather what will was, when it's always here. Do you understand what oxygen is, what air is? It's always there for you. If somehow or other the air was taken away and you fell in a lake or something, went underwater, then you know what air is, that thing which you can't access anymore. But why it's always here for you, it's very difficult to know. So will does form a central part in the path of Buddhism. And your job is to quiet it down. And you're finding it so much more peaceful. 9 o'clock. Thank you for listening. You had no choice. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.